makes me fearful that we have not figured out any way. And the reason I'm so pessimistic is because I look at our practices in Afghanistan and realize that all those wonderful promises that we gave about rebuilding Afghanistan. Did you guys realize that in the latest budget that President Bush submitted to the Congress, what was the dollar amount initially designated for reconstruction of Afghanistan? Zero. It was so embarrassing that Democratic staff, congressional staff members had to go in at the last minute and, you know, insert $320 million, okay, as a sign of largesse. Is it a wonder that President Karzai's authority does not extend beyond the borders of the city of Kabul, the capital? So the skeptic, the cynic in me says we are going to be in a store for the same. Furthermore, since I mentioned economics, let me also say, what are we going to do with the economic system of post-Saddam Iraq? Are we going to leave it to the forces, to the uncontrolled forces of free market? Let the World Bank dictate the terms, what is going to go on? Are we going to push for denationalization of Iraqi oil? Right? Nation building, after all, folks, is not just to invite McDonald's and a Starbucks, okay, and say our job is finished. What are we going to do with this issue? There is talk now. There are a certain number of names have been mentioned as people who are going to be running Iraq in the interim, right? From, as was mentioned earlier today by one of the other speakers, a guy with blood on his hands who has been responsible for the Kurdish massacre, and you know, a few other forces, including American generals and so forth. So I guess the question I want to ask is replacing Saddam with a puppet or a clientele regime, how productive is that going to be in terms of enhancing America's image in that part of the world? It will be the ultimate colonial endeavor, right? And I feel, again, as a student of history, if anything, we need to keep in the back of our mind how having these clientele regimes, the Shah in Iran, Marcos in Philippines, Somoza in Nicaragua, Noriega in Panama, Papadoc in Haiti, et cetera, how that helped the cause of democracy and so forth in these places. We are told to take a serious look at the Iraqi exiles. Well, I have been looking closely at the Iraqi exiles, and I see a bunch of people who cannot practice democracy even in Hyde Park in London, let alone in Baghdad. Ahmed Chalabi, the leader of the Iraqi opposition, the darling of our Congress, has been sentenced in absentia by a Jordanian court to life in prison on charges of swindling Petrobank, which he headed until the 1980s. So you see what type of characters, either it's the army generals or these type of corrupt civilian types or a U.S. general. None of these bodes well for the image problem that the United States is going to face in that part of the world. Now, having said these things, one can ask the legitimate question. Is the administration therefore stupid to ask or push for a regime change in Iraq? No, I don't think so. I give them more credits than that. I think these are people who are smart enough to have thought about some of the ramifications. All right? If I were making a case for the administration, again, this is as a, you know, mental exercise, let me play the role of the devil's advocate and give you some, what I consider to be rather valid arguments for one, for how one can be in favor of the war. Okay? Much of it revolves around oil. Duh. It's the Middle East after all, right? Where oil, and again, if needed, I can talk about the politics of oil in this country and how our reliance on oil, dependency on oil, has gone up and up and up. and so forth. What is the cost of producing a barrel of oil in the Middle East compared to the, you know, compared to Alaska, and therefore why all this nonsense you hear about, you know, becoming energy independent is truly nonsense. Okay, for one thing, one can make the argument that just on the economic set of factors, this is a wonderful idea. We can turn Iraq into a captive oil market, right? We can access its immense resources, over 110 billion barrels of proven oil reserves, and considerable reserves awaiting discovery. After all, remember, because of the war with Iran, the war with Kuwait, and now this war, there has not been much exploration for oil reserves in Iraq. Iraq has a treasure trove of oil, after all, that is second only to Saudi Arabia. Just yesterday, a former energy secretary wrote an editorial in LA Times, basically making the exact same argument. We should make Iraq our strategic oil reserve. Not only we pay for the cost of this conflict, but we can also do a number of other wonderful things, such as, well, okay, a pro-US Iraq can be persuaded to get out of OPEC, right? Undercut the price of oil through OPEC in return for obviously staying in power and so forth. Follow an unrestrained production strategy to bring down the price of oil. Having Iraq in your corner can also mean that you should not be so profoundly dependent on Saudi Arabia anymore, right? I mean, after all, the 9/11 attackers predominantly came from Saudi Arabia. It is an undemocratic state, okay? Very corrupt. And therefore, you prepare yourself for the eventuality that if things were to go wrong in Saudi Arabia, you have a backup plan, i.e. Iraq, the second largest oil producer. And don't forget Iraq's water resources in the Middle East that are also making it extremely influential and powerful. They say the next set of conflicts in that region are going to be over water. Scarcity of water causes it, not necessarily oil. So keep that in mind too, where Iraq sits. Okay, emasculating Iraq can also help to make it less of a challenge to Israel's military hegemony in the region. You're helping your allies and killing more than one bird with the same stone. There are also some other arguments that one can put forward about how, in the aftermath of 9/11, we have established military bases throughout Central Asia, now Afghanistan, and now Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. The president has told us that Iraq is part of an axis of evil. So one would think, as I tend to think, that the aim, the end game in this conflict is not Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. You have a group of people in the White House that are highly ideological, that in the aftermath of the demise of the Soviet Union, in the aftermath of the fact that the war in Afghanistan went better than expected, they feel a sky is the limit as far as how you can redraw the political maps of the Middle East. And therefore, this is the apt time to do so. If my reading of what the intentions are is correct, then I would say that out of the two remaining axis of evil countries, Iran and North Korea, logically, Iran should be singled out next, because the North Koreans already do have the weapons, right? And if anything, we learned a lesson that once countries do have the weapons, they are off the hook. Look at India, look at Pakistan, look at North Korea, all right? You go and get them now, at this conjuncture, before they get it. For a moment, forget about Iraq and think of the logic that this administration has given us, all right? Almost everything that this administration has said about Iraq can also be applied to Iran, with the exception of perhaps using chemical weapons against its own citizenry. Supporting terrorism, wanting to acquire weapons of mass destruction, opposition to Arab-Israeli conflict, you name it, okay? I'm no fan of the present regime in Iran, but I still think that too will be a huge, huge mistake. Let me elaborate as to why. If the history of modern Iran teaches us anything, It teaches us that foreign intervention in the political process has basically hindered, has set back the political maturation process by decades, rather than solving the problems. The revolution of 1979 was in many ways a response to our CIA-organized coup in Iran back in 1953. Remember, folks, people in that part of the world, when they speak of history, right, they do not necessarily mean an academic discipline, like many of us do. Their culture of reference, their frame for history is measured in millenniums, not in a decade or a century, right? So therefore, they are not going to easily forget and forgive. I remember I was a student at Boston University during the hostage crisis in the 1980s, and when I would tell them this story that this is really payback for 1953 coup in many ways, but they would say, but that's gone, that's past, that's old story. To many here, that's old story. To people there, it is not an old story. Okay? Especially if you had to live with the repercussions, to have to live with the consequences. After all, you install, handpick, Shah, and he stays in power for 27 years. It's not an ancient history. It's a daily reality of life. It's a daily reminder of subservience. Okay, it's a national insult, if you wish. Therefore, it's not going to be forgotten. Same this time around. The Iranian case is interesting in the following sense. This is one country that is undergoing a truly monumental transformation from within. Okay? This is one country where the reform movement has indigenous authentic roots. It did not start with, the National Institute for Democracy in Washington, D.C., promoting people and say, become democratic. It's a movement from within. In many ways, it's a response to the disillusionment with what this government was supposed to bring about. And yet, it should become obvious that any type of attack on this country now is only going to undermine what is going on and bring back that politics of extremism. It's going to strengthen the hands of a conservative constituency that has been voted out of office again and again, and yet holds on to the means of power. So they can generate, they can tap into the anti-American sentiments that is always present in that part of the world, and therefore the one case that you can have a wonderful experience of a democratic transition coming emerging can also be torpedoed. It's funny. If you look at what has been happening, that while there have been protests against the war in all the countries of the region, you hardly see any anti-war protests in Iran. I will tell you why. The reason has to do with the fact that the Iranians are torn between the fact that they despise Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi regime on the one hand, and they distrust Washington on the other. They despise Saddam Hussein because they feel having anti-war protests in Iran is in some ways an insult to the memory of the resistance, to the memory of the martyrs who gave up their life to defend their country. So they are really in an awkward position right now. All right? And yet they are not willing to jump ship and embrace the United States. So they have adopted the policy that they adopted in the case of Afghanistan, too, critical rhetoric in public and tacit cooperation in private. The war is going to have repercussions for other countries in the region as well, but I don't want to go too much into it. Let me just mention Turkey as a case in point. Here is another country where, again, accidents of history has put it in a really tough situation. For the first time since the 1920s, you have a government coming to power in Turkey with quite clear-cut Islamic credentials and sentiments. A population that is predominantly against the war. And yet, this same political party is being pressured by our administration to open up their borders to the presence of U.S. forces and so forth. So Turkey will be an interesting case also to keep an eye on because of the life and death issues that this war has created for them. Same goes for the problem that they have to deal with in the case of the Kurds. Now, let me, in the interest of time, turn to some other topics, and I would be more than happy to entertain questions about particular countries in the region. Those of us who feel that we are a bit skeptical about how this bombing campaign is going to produce results, I don't think we are just, you know, out in the wonderland, people who have closed their eyes to the reality out there. I want to read to you a long list of countries that we have bombed since World War II. And let me come to a question at the very end of that list. Since World War II, we have bombed China, Korea, Guatemala, Indonesia, Cuba, Guatemala, more than one time, Peru, Laos, Vietnam, Cambodia, Grenada, Lebanon, Libya, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Iran, Panama, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and so forth. In which of these countries have our bombings produced a democratic state? The answer is exactly between 0 and 1, right? We have a hard time with that logic. We do realize that in many ways we have made mistakes. Maybe I shouldn't be employing the word we, but I mean this administration or this country has made a mistake. Yes, for the last 40 years, this government has made mistakes against Iraq, which meant that the Kurds, the Iraqi Shiites, the Iranians, the Kuwaitis, and so forth paid for those mistakes. Right? Therefore, the joke in the beginning about keeping the receipts and looking the other way around when Iraq was using those weapons in the 1980s. I'm afraid that this administration, based on two factors, really, the fatal combination of arrogance and ignorance, has decided that it is going to redraw the geostrategic maps of the Middle East. And I'm afraid they are not going to come out of this issue in a successful fashion, because again, here, reality might impose itself on the type of ideological unilateralist beliefs that this administration has embraced. If we were to look at the connection between these events from 9/11 to now, we will realize that how prosecuting and going after terrorists, okay, has now gone to the next stage, has mushroomed into something much larger, much more nebulous, okay? And that is taking care of all those states that we do not agree with, we don't like. The discourse coming out of Washington reminds one of Imperial Rome with its responsibilities, reminiscent of Julius Caesar. Our officials use such phrases as "we will place," "install," "dictate," and so forth. Our talking heads speak of Iraq as if it is nothing but a huge gas station that needs to serve us. And they are salivating at the prospects for a captive oil market in Iraq. I am afraid that the scenario we are confronting is more along the lines of Somalia rather than anything else. You will win the battles, perhaps, but somehow end up losing the war because you have not figured it out politically. Notice how vague this administration is about its plans for a post-Saddam Iraq. What is its exit strategy if things were not to work out? They were supposed to. Again, please look historically. Before we went to Somalia, there were all these wonderful, you know, blueprints about what was going to happen. And I won't even mention Vietnam. Now, I don't think the discourse should really stop at criticizing the folks in Foggy Bottom. I'm afraid we are responsible as individual citizens. It seems to me that Americans don't like not to be liked and feel that therefore their sacrifices in blood and resources makes it hard for anyone, or makes it hard for most Americans, to accept, let alone fathom the notion about any expression of dislike from abroad. Whether it is merely a questioning of U.S. tactics by our European allies, all right, or the sentiment coming out of the Middle East and so forth, we are bewildered by the Europeans, all right, and resort to those, what I will call, naive and stupid cliches about Arab and Muslim world. Again, someone referred to the notion of why don't they like us? I have done this test in my Middle East politics classes again and again. I ask my students who give me all this nonsense about, yeah, why they don't like us and so forth, and I ask them, can you name for me three Arab authors that you have read to substantiate your claims? Not a single name, or at best, a single name is mentioned. Okay? You understand why I want to direct some of my comments about us as individual citizens and our responsibilities rather than taking the easy way out and just blaming the folks in Washington, D.C. I want to draw everyone's attention to an article. It's either forthcoming or has just appeared in Newsweek by Farid Zakaria. I want to read to you a paragraph from that article and want you to think about the implications. He says, America's special role in the world, its ability to buck history, is based not simply on its great strength, but on a global fate that this power is legitimate. If America squanders that, the loss will outweigh any gains in domestic security. And this next American century could prove to be lonely, brutish, and short. Now, since this conference deals with IR, international relations, let me try to wrap up things by sharing some observations about what it means, perhaps for scholars of international relations, for students of political science, and then share some departing words on all that has been said. I think this is a conflict that can be quite interesting as far as international relations is concerned, because it gives birth or perhaps substantiates, reformulates some questions that really need to be addressed now. Should coercive sanctions be imposed against governments when the population has no democratic rights? Okay, as clearly has been the case in Iraq. Has containment and deterrence failed? Again, sanctions not being an alternative to war, as this administration tells us. Are preemptive strikes legal? Do they make you more safe? Again, as the administration claims. Because again, the skeptic would say, well, look, if you're North Korea and you have been put on notice, right, that you might be subject to a preemptive strike, and it's good for the United States, are we willing to extend them the same right too, to attack us first in a preemptive strike of their own? Okay. So what it means about the legality of preemptive strikes. Similarly, the concept of terrorism, I have yet to read or come across a definition of terrorism that I find acceptable. There is a question here. The question is, will countries ever accept a legal definition of terrorism for what is essentially a political problem? So scholars, students interested in international law need to really wrestle with this issue of what is a working definition of terrorism for us. All sorts of other questions. Is unilateralism the way of the future? Okay. The title of my presentation was, is 9/11, Afghanistan and Iraq, the down payment on a new world order? Are we going to see more of these type of issues? I leave it up to you to draw your own conclusion as to, you know, where we are heading. But I think we need to be reflecting, both as active citizens as well as scholars, we need to be reflecting on these set of issues. I am firmly convinced that this is a war, the present war, is one that the Bush administration chose to fight, but did not have to fight. Even if this war goes better than expected, it is going to have long-term consequences. Even if those long-term consequences are entirely positive, still it doesn't take away anything from the fact that it was not necessary to begin with. And if it goes badly, whether in the form of high U.S. casualties, civilian casualties on the part of Iraqis, a heightened risk of terrorism around the world, increased hatred of the United States and so forth, then the architects of this policy have a lot to answer for. What disturbs me is the fact that I'm afraid for most of us, again, perhaps not in this room, but in this society as a whole, a quick victory will be gratefully ratified by the American public. So, in short, I am accusing you and myself, all of us, really, of complicity of silence when we whisper approvingly in the context of being majority opinions. In these conformist times that we live in, the American street seems to have been tamed to the notion of war and its inevitability. I want to warn you against accepting these, you know, I must say, again, as somebody who studies this region of the world, there is more nonsense written about Islam and the Middle East than any other religion or region of the world that I know of. And people manage to get away with that. I want us to really start doing some soul searching here. Again, Cynthia pointed out the question of why do they hate us? If there is rampant anti-Americanism in that part of the world, is it really based on a hatred of modernity? Is it based on your values, as the president told us? All right? Or is this anti-Americanism based on a concrete narrative of interventions and specific depredations? There is a big difference in terms of how we formulate this problem for ourselves. Thomas Friedman, a man whom I do not often agree with, said, "The root cause of the problem in the Middle East has to do with the poverty of dignity and deficit of freedom." He got it right this time. Indeed, it has to do with poverty of dignity, that in many ways, we and those regimes, authoritarian regimes that we have been in bed with for so long, have helped to inflict on the public. The deficit of freedom is way too real. That needs to be acknowledged. But if Friedman is right? If Friedman is right about these two issues, then these are the roots of terrorism. These are the fruits of terrorism. We need to ask ourselves the difference between roots and fruits of the terrorism issue. And again, ask those set of hard questions. In light of 9/11, since I mentioned this deficit of freedom, poverty of dignity, what has happened is that our government has been strong arming the local governments just so that they would support us in our cause. Right? As somebody nicely put it, this is not the coalition of the willing, but the coalition of the billing. All right? Who have all been charging their own, asking for their own goodies. Well, look, the gravy trail continues. People are siding with us because we are telling them about, you know, the fact that they will be deprived of aid packages and so forth and so on. And in the meantime, the war on terrorism has meant that we have basically decided to look the other way around as these governments go on silencing the voice of dissent in their own countries under the guise of fighting terrorism. Right? So I would say the cumulative end result of the entire process so far has not been an improvement of human rights, but quite the opposite. Look at what is going on in Central Asia, in some of the Central Asian states, and what the political establishment has been able to do under the banner of fighting terrorism since 9/11. I am afraid that this war will inject, and not just the Iraqi campaign, But the type of discourse that is coming out of the White House these days, this is going to inject new life into moribund radical groups and undermine in many ways the slow, gradual process of openness that has been taking place in some of these countries. The British have a saying that says, revenge is a dish best served cold. If we go after our enemies with the same zeal that Captain Ahab had in pursuit of Moby Dick, you know what's going to happen. The attacks of 9/11, in my view, were an attack on democracy, but they were not a threat to democracy. The foundations of American democracy, in my view, is much stronger than a few buildings crumbling. We should not, therefore, allow a government that infringes on our civil rights more and more as we go on. Ashcroft has become our modern-day Leviathan. And it seems that we have unwillingly accepted, granted him the mandate of being that Leviathan. In my view, the Bush administration and all of us really sitting in this room, we should be doing more listening and less preaching if we are really to get into that bottom root of what is going on, why the hatred, why the animosities and grievances. And I want to warn you against readily embracing this madman scenario. Okay? Saddam Hussein is not a madman. I'm willing to have an extensive discussion on this issue. When we depict our enemies as madmen, we are basically telling ourselves and the others that therefore they cannot have any type of legitimate grievance worthy of listening to. A man who has stayed in power in the Middle East with the turmoil of that region for 24 years is not suicidal. Nor, in my view, was Gaddafi a madman. Nor was Khomeini a madman. But unfortunately, again, we, the citizens, have been tamed into this notion of accepting this peculiarly American black and white picture of the world. When our administration again comes out with the statements like, you're either with us or against us and so forth and so on. Another guy who I don't often agree with is Pat Buchanan. You know him, right? Okay. Pat Buchanan had two statements that I thought are worthy of reflecting on. The first was, interventionism is the incubator of terrorism. Somebody used the word that 9/11 was payback time for our previous practices. Okay? If you are being perceived as a hegemonic imperial power that tells other people how to live their lives, what type of political system they can have or they cannot have, if we have become the 9/11 of the world, okay, then there is going to be obviously repercussions. The second statement of Pat Buchanan that I think worth considering, despite the personality of the man, is the following. He asked, are we a republic or an empire? And therefore, I want to end with a sentence from another guy who I don't necessarily agree with. Napoleon. Napoleon said, in one of his most colorful phrases, every empire has died from indigestion. Afghanistan was a mouthful. Iraq might give us heartburn. Revamping the entire Middle East may lead to constipation. You can guess the rest of what is in store for us. Thank you.
You're the first person that I've heard to talk about an Islamic leadership in Iraq. It's always been the crazy guy who's been hanging out in Denmark, or in America in general, do you feel that, sort of given the legacy of Ayatollah Khomeini, that as a radical, or sort of fundamentalist, I know that's a loaded word, government could be formed in Iraq along the principles of a supreme jurist? And do you feel that an attack on Iran is truly imminent? And do you feel that given the sort of vestiges of such a strong Islamic government in Iran, do you feel that that would be viewed as an attack of the Christian world versus the Muslim world even more than this current war is?
Yeah. First question. Please note something about the demographic composition of Iraq in terms of religious affiliation, right? You have a country where you have some 65% of the population being Shiites. Around 18% are Iraqi Kurds, and another 15% Iraqi Sunnis, right? Arab Sunnis. The political power for the longest time has been in the hands of the Arab Sunnis, not the Shiite majority and not the Kurds, right? You add up the numbers, the 65 and the 18%, and the obviously some of the other, you know, Christian minorities and so forth and so on, you end up with the following conclusion, right? That religious minorities, or majorities in Iraq, I must say, have quite serious significant grievances, right? And therefore, if there is to be a quote-unquote democratic state, one man, one vote, et cetera, you should prepare yourself for the fact that they are going to act upon these religious sentiments. Let me say something. I am not fearful necessarily that there is a threat of Islamic fundamentalism taking over in Iraq. I say for the following reason. Iraqis are some of the most educated people in the Arab world, right? There is a famous saying in the Arab world which says, Egyptians write, Lebanese publish, Iraqis read, right? They have a reputation for truly being men and women of letters, right? Iraq has a sizable, quite a significant, you know, solid middle class, or it used to have. Obviously, their standard of living has taken a nosedive. But therefore, you are facing the following problem, right? Please realize that secularism in our part of the world does not necessarily have the same positive connotations that necessarily it might have in the streets of France or United States, right? The legacy of secularism that people in the Middle East have had to deal with has been authoritarian, dictatorial secularism, okay? Therefore, is it far-fetched to argue that just like it has happened in other parts of this region, right, religion is going to make a comeback. It is going to fill an ideological vacuum. And I think we should live with that, okay? As far as your second question, I hope that Iran is not the next target. I take heart in the fact that even Tony Blair, right, will have a hard time signing off on such a policy. I also take heart in the fact that this administration was forced to spend so much political capital on the Iraqi war that they realize it should be suicidal, right, if you aren't going to, you know, go after Iran's or North Korea's of the world. Well, maybe not in this term, after 2004 perhaps, but not now.
You drew a parallel between Iraq and Iran as far as sort of the style of the regime and the United States' disagreement with a lot of their policies, the suppression that goes on. And you also said that the United States needs to do more listening, which I wholeheartedly agree with. But Iran, I was reading this just in the months before, mm-hmm. all you could read about was Iraq and all the military buildups, that there's a great deal of internal sort of liberalization there. I mean, a lot more people are able to speak their minds without feeling persecuted. I'm not saying that the persecution isn't still there or what kind of suppression there is, but did you see any sort of liberalization domestically in Iraq?
In Iraq or Iran?
In Iraq, the sort of trend that you now see in Iran.
No, I think because you know, even though the first three letters of the country's names are the same, there is a world of difference between the two, right? In Iran, you have had a government that came to power through a genuine revolution, right? And I will make the argument that it did enjoy a great deal of popular support in its early stages, right? But gradually, disillusionment with the politics of extremism that the present government pursued, okay, managed to alienate a good chunk of the Iranian society, right? The option that they opted for, they decided to go, you know, experiment with, flirt with, was the idea of, can we reform a regime, a government that was genuinely popular in its early stages from within, right? Therefore, the cerebral talent of the intellectual elite in Iran was spent on this very question: can we reform a revolutionary movement from within, rather than throwing the baby with the bathwater, right? In Iraq, unfortunately, you know, during the time of Saddam Hussein's rule in particular, okay, there has not been that room for dissent, okay? Anyone, you know, I mean, again, if you do not read the local languages, read the book called Republic of Fear, okay, by Kanan Makia. And you get a sense, and another one, Torture and Cruelty, okay? And you get a sense of what is really, you know, the iron fist policy that Saddam Hussein's government pursued. It wasn't like this. Remember, look, Baathism was a progressive ideology, right? It had elements, it was a happy marriage of socialist thinking with Arab nationalism, right? The practice, the political praxis in Iraq in the 1950s and 1960s and early 70s was not what you saw under Saddam Hussein, right? Since the Iraqi revolution in 1958, I mean, go and compare, for example, what was happening in Iraq between 1958 and 1979. The difference is between day and night. All right. So that's why at the beginning of my talk, I said, unfortunately, I think Saddam does bear certain responsibility. And, I get the sense that this is mostly a, you know, pro-peace crowd. Okay. But I think we need to realize this, okay, that we should not be clearing our conscience cheaply, either by closing our eyes on the atrocities committed on the part of these third world authoritarian regimes, right? Nor should we come across as blindly, dutifully following what the White House wants us to believe. Perhaps some of the voices you heard today.
You know, you said that you don't think that this administration has been bloodied enough by its attempt and its cost so much to attack Iraq that it might not go into Iran. I'm not so sure, because the stranglehold the administration has on our own press, you know, to convince the American people to go along with anything they want, for one thing. And the roots of this, they keep saying, is a, you know, like payback for 9/11. But in fact, its roots go way back to 1978-79, the Kissinger policy or proposal, which was to the only way we could guarantee access to oil was to control all of Middle East. And I wonder if you have any comments about the Kissinger doctrine.
Well, look, post-World War II, US policy toward Middle East basically was based on three major pillars, right? One was oil, because of, you know, how crucial it is to the economic lifeblood of this country, right? Second was containment of Soviet Union. Therefore, the Truman Doctrine and so forth that we saw implemented in places like Greece, Turkey, etc. And finally was support for Israel, no matter who rules that country, right? Those were, in my view, those were the three major pillars of American foreign policy, regardless of whether they were Democrats or Republicans, okay? Okay, containment of Soviet Union has become more or less obsolete now. You don't see them talking about Russia with the same vengeance. Kissinger is on record, for example, regarding the Iran-Iraq War, which, as you know, was the bloodiest conflict since World War II. His argument was that there should be no victor. Let there be no victor in this war. This is part of his 800-page memoirs on diplomacy, right? Let there be no victor in that war. So I don't think the American policy has fundamentally changed as far as how they view the Middle East. In my view, these folks in White House have concluded that 9/11 has created a sea change, right? In this country, overseas and so forth, for them to go about and assert themselves in that hegemonic fashion that they think is worthy of the only superpower left standing.
Since many of the pitfalls of the road that the administration has taken was pointed out by the State Department study on the consequences of our action, that I just want you to comment on whether or not there is another motive for the action he's taken, namely to transform America and change the present social contract that we have grown up with in my generation as to the relationship of government and people. Namely, he wants to stay in power and change the society. In other words, he's acting only for internal purposes, for that purpose. What's your reaction to that?
No, I don't think I will subscribe to that line of thinking. I think, yes, you do have an administration that, is so heavily employing, a religious rhetoric, right? The parlance coming out of the White House in particular is full of this type of rhetoric, sense of righteousness, okay? But I don't think the intent was to reconfigure domestic politics. That might be a byproduct of what is going on, okay? In terms of prosecuting the war on terrorism and so forth. But I don't think, again, I might be wrong, but I don't see really any evidence at this conjuncture that the social contract is about to change. Okay. Yes, again, as some speakers before me pointed out, it is troubling. It is troubling what is going on, what is happening in terms of civil liberties. Okay. And how, again, I want to draw back, reemphasize the point I made earlier. The ball is in our court as active citizens, right? To speak out on what we see as being the wrong trends.
I think it would be likely that Iran would be the next step in a war sometime in the future, but also Iran right now there's a lot of tension, right? Or whether it's going to be liberated or not. And as an Iranian, which direction do you think that it's going?
You mean in terms of the future prospects of the reform movement underway in Iran?
Yeah.
Well, I've written extensively on this issue, so I can refer you to some of those writing. But let me just say that I am still guardedly optimistic about what is going on. I have been making frequent travels to Iran over the last few years, and every time I go, I come back more impressed, right, by how fundamentally that society has changed, how sophisticated the level of political discussion has become. You see, unfortunately, since there is very serious red lines drawn by the state in terms of what can be said and what cannot be said, the public exhibitions are not the best way of judging what is going on. You really need to get inside the houses, have conversation with university students, the intellectual give and take that happens on a one-to-one setting, to really grasp how fundamentally the place has changed, okay? And I say this with some degree of confidence, not on account of any type of chauvinistic sentiment. I seriously, as I look around in the Islamic world, I see this is one place where the level of discussion happens to be much more sophisticated than what goes on in other parts. Perhaps because they have lived through, right, what an Islamic revolution was supposed to be. So to answer your question, I think at this conjuncture, we are dealing with a society in which the citizenry is way ahead of the politicians, right? In other words, they are finding fault with the reformist president and his people as well, that you are not going fast enough, far enough, in questioning the conservatives' grip over power. So, in my view, therefore, keeping our hands off from Iran and allowing this process to end up, okay, to figure out its problem on its own, would be the wisest thing to do, and not necessarily to intervene and therefore bring back all these nativistic anti-imperialist sentiments that are going to once again, you know, surface there.
I am opposed to this war. I say that because some of what I'm about to say may not sound like it. I was in London on September 11th, and one of the other people working in the same office building I was in was a young man in his 30s from Lebanon. He carried shrapnel from the war there. And we were talking one day, and he said, you know, if you, about the attack on Afghanistan, and he says, you know, if you really wanted to galvanize support in the Middle East, you'd get rid of Saddam Hussein. In other words, I also am very hesitant about characterizing the Middle East as a kind of univocal area. Mm-hmm. I think there's going to be a heck of a lot of people who are very happy when Saddam Hussein is gone. It, to me, that doesn't mitigate my sense of profound moral wrong, and I would say danger to our own democracy by taking this action. But I do think we need to be very clear that there will be people who are quite happy that he's not there. I also agree with your larger point, if I take it correctly, which is that my feeling is that right now the anti-war demonstrations, which I think are heartening to all of us, are misplaced. And we're not, as an organized movement, paying enough attention to the question of what happens next. And I think that we have to stop asking questions and start saying what we want to have happen next. Because I think, from my own reading, there are sufficient people around President Bush who know very well what they want and who are not at all concerned about the issues having to do with fairness, legitimacy, as long as there's a fig leaf of democracy. We know that contracts have already been let to Halliburton. We know contracts have already been let to Bechtel. We know that the alienation of the United Nations could well play into the hand of an American-sponsored rebuilding of Iraq that excludes the UN. And I do agree with you, for all of the pundits who say that they don't sense this is about oil, well, I'm sorry. It seems to me to be about oil. So my question is, where is the conversation going on that doesn't ask the administration what next, but begins to formulate an answer to that question that is in fact stabilizing, that is in fact multilateral, and that does in fact have enough strategic and moral vision to prevent those people who really would like to see Iran be next, then Syria, with the great prize Egypt, to quote a briefing given by the RAND Corporation to some of Bush's advisors?
Let me first say that I agree with everything you said. I too share that sentiment, as I said at the beginning, that I think there would be a lot of people happy that Saddam Hussein is gone. I mean, my heart really goes out to the Iraqi people who have had to endure three devastating wars because of this regime, right? Let me share you one story, how it resonates with me as an individual. I'm serving as the director of graduate studies for the political science department at Syracuse University. Last year, I got an email from an Iraqi graduate student inquiring about the possibility of getting an I-20 from our department and coming to the States. But the last line, he told me what his TOEFL scores are and so forth, and you know, obviously, he was not going to cut it, right, to make it to the top list. So I wrote him back, and I said, I'm sorry, you know, we have this many applications, and your academic credentials does not warrant an admission letter. He wrote back to me and said, yes, I know, but I didn't want to tell you the truth. The truth is I have a daughter, 2-year-old, who is, you know, about to die because of lack of medication, and I feel that by getting an I-20, that might be my only chance of bringing her to the States, right? Those are stories that stay with you. Right? They touch you. So I am absolutely with you about the fact of, you know, Saddam Hussein's leaving would be a good thing, perhaps, for the Iraqi people. But my point, again, is the following. If past experience along the lines that we have done in other places, okay, most recently in Afghanistan, is any indication, I'm not holding my breath, right, that we are going to be the championing of that democratic politics in Iraq. I am sorry, but you know, when when you read Shimon Peres and Ariel Sharon saying that the war has just started, United States should go after Iran, Syria, Libya next, right? That leads me to believe that, yes, there are people who are trying to fundamentally reconfigure, right, the political boundaries of that region. And I think it's our responsibility as informed citizens to intervene in that political discourse, to say, yes, you're absolutely right. We cannot be fighting something that has happened or is about to happen, right? I think the anti-war movement is missing the boat. If the discourse is still, we should not have gone to the war in the first place. Well, we need to wake up. It has happened. It's about to happen. It's taking place as we speak, right? And the Iraqi government is not going to be there, you know, after a few more weeks at best, right? So the discourse is now about, okay, we are going to hold your foot to the fire, right? You said you are going to have a long-term commitment to rebuilding Iraq and so forth and so on. But the signs are not optimistic. Richard Perle, you mentioned the UN. Richard Perle, who, as you know, is Mr. Bush's Defense Policy Board chairman, just wrote an article. This is what he said about the UN. Let me paraphrase. UN is the chatterbox on the Hudson. He even got his geography wrong, since it's on the East River. But anyhow, this is what he says. What will die is the fantasy of the UN as the foundation of a new world order. The liberal concept of safety through international law administered by international institutions. Mr. Perle is writing the obituary for the UN, right? This president has told us that unilateralism is the new order of the day. Okay? As far as what we need to do, I think these are the points of contention that we can pick a fight on, right? And insist on why the UN still should be considered as the conscience of the world community, the forum where you mediate conflicts, and so forth and so on. But past practice doesn't make me optimistic. Assad was talking about what Madeleine Albright said to Boutros-Ghali, right? Who we got rid of because we didn't want him his independence. And Kofi Annan right now, I mean, the question that I have in back of my mind is, where are you, Mr. Annan, right? Maybe you want to ask that of our speaker this afternoon about how we have managed to undermine the authority of the UN. And I know tomorrow we are going to go back to the UN and say, if you do not take responsibility for reconstruction of Iraq, guess what? We are not giving you the money we owe you, right? So arm twisting and high-handedness has been a popular practice of this administration.
Thank you very much, Mirzad. Mirzad Bojedi speaking on Afghanistan and Iraq, down payment on the New World Order, from a forum held earlier this week at Hobart and William Smith in Geneva. Thanks to Professor Kevin Dunn for organizing the forum and to Roy of the Hobart William Smith Audiovisual Department for this tape, and to the Christmas Coup comedy players, Randy Critico, Janet Coleman, and David Dozier. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guests, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. You can contact us via our website at www.unwelcomeguests.com. .org. Unwelcome travelers, another brave